This is Jack LaFleur. Alaska is one of the last major relatively undisturbed wildlife habitats left on our planet. It is an island of hope where vast stretches of wilderness are protected by the National Park Service, where waters still run clean, where the landscape is not as yet overrun by any species, where the human animal does not necessarily live at the top of the food chain. Many of the humans who do inhabit the land of the midnight sun live in reciprocity with their native habitat, where language and lifeway are determined in part by the nature of their environment, by the spirit of place. Elaine Thatcher is a folklorist who came to understand early on that biotic and cultural diversity are completely intertwined, and that for traditional cultures to prosper, their habitats must remain healthy. She visited southeastern Alaska and conducted interviews with those who respectfully wrest their subsistence from land and sea.
Southeast Alaska is a place shaped on a grand scale by natural forces still observable to humans. Glaciers cover much of the landscape, and where they have receded, new forests have sprung up, providing new places for settlement and habitat. The Huna Tlingit people have lived around the Glacier Bay area for about 4,000 years. They have seen the glaciers advance and recede, and they know how to live on the land and water. Now, in the context of United States statehood and its legal system, the people, primarily of the Chukanedi clan, live year-round in their former winter camp, the village of Huna, and have very little access to their former hunting and fishing grounds, now within the borders of Glacier Bay National Park. Wilbur James, Jr. is an elder in Huna. He and younger tribal members Wanda Culp and Frank Wright, Jr. talk about the difficulties of maintaining a traditional lifestyle under federal regulation and with modern American ideas making their way into Alaskan native life.
The ice made a rapid advance in Glacier Bay, and in a few years' time, all the Chukanedi, the Huna Tlingit, had to move. And there was one lady, the Chukanedi grandmother, Costine. She refused to leave because it is her homeland. So they placed blankets and food around her when they were getting ready to go. Furs and everything, covered her body with it. And because she refused to leave. When they were leaving, they stopped by Pleasant Island and they sang a song. They composed it right then and there. It's a very sad song. It's called Ishan Song. It's in memory of that woman. And even today, not only the Chukanedi Tlingit celebrate what this woman did in the love she had for the land, she refused to leave, she let the ice cover her. In her memory, Kade. The first time the words were uttered was Costine Kade, that's putting on this lady Costine. Even today when you have a payoff party and you remember a loved one that you're paying off for and you're putting out money, like it's $5, $10, $20 for each person you're going to name, you say the same thing as my mother, Kade, in honor of my mother. But you are also remembering Costine. In the springtime, up till the middle of May or the end of May, the mountain goats shed their winter hair. And there's high altitude alder. It just grows. You've seen it, haven't you? It's real tough stuff. And it's just like that, just miles of it. And mountain goats will go along these trails and then they'll rub on here to pull the winter fur off. And that's what we did. I remember when I was very small. The one that took us there was Lonnie Houston and my uncle Silas Dalton. When we went up there, we gathered mountain goat wool. We got sacks and sacks of it. Then they have a big ceremony and a big party with Klukwan and Haines people, and they lay this on them. And something like a payoff for past favors done or whatever, you know.
And now the wool gathering isn't that way anymore because there's laws against it. Glacier Bay has extended their boundaries into up there where we can't go into Glacier Bay and even gather stuff like this. It's laws, it's a rule. You know, we can't even go in and shoot seal, like they said we could with a memorandum of understanding with the Huni Indian Association. That is not true. They still say we can't hunt in Glacier Bay. We can't go in there and gather any food unless it's on their little list of berries and roots. Physically, we do go in there and hunt, but the park, Greg Brown's case didn't change that for us, and the park is now aware that we are actually going even as far as right into Bartlett Cove and seal hunt right under their noses, but they're not changing their rules over it, their laws. They still have a federal mandate that's coming up, that seven-year study that the park did, and the study is the impacts of commercial fishing within the park. Well, if you're going to study impacts, then you better do it with us present in there, because we are present in there, which I think is what Frank was saying. And yet their study is not going to be complete because it eliminates us from there. We're not welcome there. We know it. We have to go up there under our conditions as well as their conditions change our conditions.
The reason why my skin is brown is because of the land and the food and everything that I use in this area. Everything off the beach, everything out of the woods, everything. I'm a different color because of the environment, and I am part of the environment.
The trees that you look at are like our culture. Underneath the ground, all the roots are entwined. They're all together, and this is what holds our culture together. We're all related. And with that in mind, if you look around at what the harvesting is doing and the wind falls, all of the damage this harvesting has done, it's a good example of what's happening to our culture. Because once the roots are entwined together, brings strength. And once that is broken, it weakens everything. And this is where our culture is at right now. We're not strong anymore.
They always talk about sport fishing. And that's something our people don't do. We don't play with a fish. You know, all these sport hunters and everything, they all say, well, we got a good one in and I had to let it go. And there's no way we'd do that. You know, we respect the animals and all the fisheries that comes around us. We take it and we bring it home. Don't play with it. At our table, we all say, don't play with your food. It's a rule. You know, it's just something that's there. We don't do something like that. So that's respect, religious respect on nature and the environment of our people.
Two laws have had major impact on the land and native peoples of Alaska. Local conversations are peppered with references to ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, and ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act of 1980. ANCSA created native corporations partly to provide a means for returning profits from harvesting natural resources to the native people. In Huna, two native corporations control most of the land, Sea Alaska and Huna Totem. The corporations pay dividends to tribal members. They also have heritage foundations that focus on protection of cultural resources. Floyd Peterson has lived in Huna all his life and became alarmed when he saw that the native corporations were clear-cutting acres of trees right across the water from his house.
The subsistence lifestyle is still going on. And the management plan stated that each household uses like 6 deer a year. And they do a lot of berry picking and clam digging and seal hunting. And the culture is still going strong. But after this logging, not only is the culture devastated, but any future industry. Like I'm in the charter business. I take tourists out sightseeing, whale watching, fishing. And they hate to see this. I lost a lot of business just this year because they don't want to come in and see this huge clear cut.
Bald mountains.
And it's getting worse every year. So what's in the future? The logging lasts for 10 to 15 more years, and then what after that? We sit there in a pile of stumps no subsistence lifestyle, no tourism. And this is what these small communities thrive on, is subsistence. Corporate interests. They were put into the position to look after our interests. But when this happened in 1972, the Settlement Act went into effect in 1972, we didn't have any concern because we thought that the stewards of the land, these native corporations, would log under stringent principles to safeguard the culture of the people. They put a lot of emphasis on art, you know, your dancing and native arts, totem pole carving and heritage. They have a heritage foundation, but what we have to get across to the younger generation is that all this art is in celebration of the land. And without the land, you don't have any culture. You don't have anything to celebrate. The board of directors are native, but they hire Caucasians as officers. Some of the officers are Tlinkets, but they're city Tlinkets. They don't understand the true native culture because they were born and raised in an urban area.
Greg Streveler is a biologist who worked for many years for the National Park Service. His friend Bill Brown is a historian and writer who also worked for the Park Service. Both men now consult from their homes in Gustavus, Alaska, just across Icy Strait from Hoona.
All of these things were done, in some sense, by the native people, but by the corporate native people, and they end up having that flavor about them, which almost by its nature, since white society has a very hard time dealing with place and dealing with tradition, it's reflected in all these laws, because that's where it came from. The white folks worked with the native people that could understand them and they could understand, and crafted a solution that was then imposed on the traditional people.
I don't want to be sounding as though these efforts at some kind of equitable solution, some kind of balancing between local and national interests has been all bad, or was certainly not intended to be all bad. I think that the Native Claims Settlement Act was granted that the foundations and framework were laid by people who were already a foot in each camp, at least, was an attempt to achieve an equitable solution. I think that the means used were highly questionable because what they did was they inserted a non-indigenous mode of getting things done and organizing finance and society and so on. I think that the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act was an attempt by a nation that had seen most of its expanse degraded by industrial scale agriculture, timbering, urbanization, sprawl, and all the rest. And they looked upon Alaska as a place that, limited in its road network, limited in population, as a place that could be saved from that fate. And in order to patch up some of the problems, they did things like they put in Section 8 of that act, providing for subsistence. This started as an enlightened view. And as far as the statutory intent was concerned, I think it probably was an enlightened view. What happened was that internal population and demographic dynamics soon found that the subsistence provisions, which were organized around the mode of people with a history and cultural identification with the site, could continue to live off the land, granted with some rules and regulations relating to national parks and refuges. And nevertheless, the fairness and equity issue there soon became prey to personalities, changing administrations, and a very overt exploitative mode by entrepreneurial interests, land speculation interests, and so on and so forth, to use subsistence to make money instead of using subsistence to help people carry on ongoing cultures. The idea of landscapes of cultural choice, which was at the root of the subsistence idea, was a good idea. in implementation and by way of assault and attack from external exploitative forces, it has become a very difficult and dubious situation. It's a tragedy. It's another example of, tragedy of commons, as far as I'm concerned. It's awfully hard to do good work. There is a sense, even with those relatively successful and moving efforts, there's a sense of just a grand contextual erosion of these efforts. And it becomes a matter of desperation. The language dies, all the nuances of language that are, the cues and clues to what's happening on the landscape. Organic education, where people follow in the footsteps of their uncles and their fathers and their aunts and their mothers and so on and so forth. The integration of men and women, say, in a hunter-gatherer society, all of them on the move, all of them hunting, all of them part of that, all of a sudden permanent villages that were installed when trading posts came, when forced schooling came, and when the rifle came, so that community hunts were no longer necessary, small groups of people could go out and hunt. We're talking about air transportation came, you can get into town, your isolation was broken. We're talking about major incremental layerings of historical change. In most places that have come at cataclysmic pace.
The town of Gustavus is situated on one of the few flat places in southeast Alaska. The glaciers receded from the land within the last 200 years. The land itself is slowly springing upward out of Icy Strait, still recovering from the weight of the glacier in a process known as isostatic rebound. The population of Gustavus is mostly modern homesteaders and others seeking land and independence. Morgan DeBeer, a descendant of the first white settlers and who is now building a golf course for the community on his family's land, values the resourcefulness that this land requires of its human inhabitants.
I just educated myself on golf courses. I didn't even play the game till several years ago, but I could see the potential. Just because you don't know something about a project, it shouldn't scare you away, okay? Because the way I tell people would be like, if you realized you had oil on your land, but you didn't know anything about oil, that wouldn't keep you from putting in a hot derrick. If my family can climb the Chilkoot Pass, my grandmother can raise a bunch of kids out here in absolute isolation, and my mother can come out of a town of less than 24 people and get her doctorate degree and straight ace it. I don't know, to me building a golf course looks like a piece of cake.
Jim Makoviak is a historian and fish wholesaler who has lived in Gustavus for many years.
The thing that myself and a lot of people are concerned with is there's so much wealth here that managed properly, we could go on forever. We could be exporting meaning sending to California or wherever, some finished wood products. We could be exporting fish. We could be bringing tourists in. And we could continue with our subsistence activities, which are real important. I mean, my family, I guess because I'm in the seafood business, I mean, we eat seafood 4 or 5 days a week. We garden. Everybody likes picking berries. They just like being out. You know, it's true over in Huna to a greater extent. I mean, the people there have been living off the land forever, and it's just part of the way of life here.
What makes an economy sustainable?
I guess not living off your capital, and the capital in the case here is the quality of the ocean water, quality of the forests, and that's in a real general sense. in Gustavus, the limiting thing may be the quality of the groundwater. There's a lot of people that are building homes on 1 acre parcels. They've got a shallow well and they've also got a septic system, and their neighbor next door has a shallow well and a septic system. I think that's kind of the limiting factor here. Once a few people start realizing they're probably drinking polluted water and they've polluted it themselves, that could make things not sustainable, I guess. So maybe here it's just having a big enough chunk of land that you're, can deal with the waste you produce, the biological waste and sewage, and still get clean water off of it there. It's a real pleasure to live here, and a lot of us are very committed to seeing it, even if things change, to seeing the quality of the capital be retained. Again, you know, clean water and good healthy forests, not tree farms. For instance, in Hoonah, I mean, they've had so much logging there that it'd be pretty hard for them to get any kind of sustainable industry going on there, since most of the forest has just been cut.
I think for most indigenous people, the idea that we can just kind of come in and, boom, establish a homeland is something they don't accept with a great deal of ease. But the law, the Alaska Lands Act, or the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act of 1980, recognized precisely what you're talking about. It wasn't limited only to Native people. It took into account a long history of what is now the United States, of European peoples coming to the New World and establishing themselves and establishing traditions and approaches and, you know, frontiers, westward expansion, and so on. In Alaska, I think it's a particularly apt notion because a lot of people have fled the lower 48 because it no longer has that old history potential. It's too crowded, it's too busy, and so you do have a couple of levels of homeland approach. You have the indigenous peoples who have been here from time immemorial, and you have people who are trying to prolong an earlier European-based America. There are at least two levels of homeland.
White people have moved here and they'll move on. And that drives the Palenque people nuts because, like Bill says, they're presented with this kaleidoscopic view of us. From year to year, there's never the same faces. And the white people, as an average, I would say, don't make near the commitment that the native people do to staying here. That's one of the difficulties in communicating. And I think also one of the difficulties in land stewardship is that we're still the frontier here, and most people are just sort of testing the waters, and most of them have not made a commitment to stay. If the economy is good, they'll stay. If not, they're out of here.
There was an old miner I knew up in the gates of the Arctic zone who said, you know, it's the failures that stay. The guys that made the big strike, they went right to Seattle. The people who make up the community are the people who didn't hit the big strike, but they just happened to fall in love with the country. They had time to do it. And I think in Southeast you have more of that. I think in Southeast you have more of a sense of sustainability. For one thing, you're dealing very largely with wildlife harvests, fish and so on. And I think that tends to integrate you more, rather than just tearing down a mountain and getting some gold out and hauling freight.
One of the sort of formative principles of my life has been to listen as closely to the land as I can, to hear what it is, it's capable of, what it is, where it's going, where it's been, and how one as a citizen of it might fit that plan. In order to live that way, one is constantly, of course, confronted with other imperatives in life that cause a various degree of compromise with that. And the barge comes in every month, and I have stuff on the barge like other people do, and clothes I wear come from somewhere else and stuff like that. But what I try to do is that where practicable, I try to be aware of the ecological cost and benefit of my existence. And the best way I can do that is by having my sustenance as close to home as possible. When I grow carrots out there and I have to run the mice out of it, I know about that. I know what it costs. I know if I have to deal with the root maggots in my cabbage, I know what that costs because I've thought about it a lot and I've watched it and I've actually manipulated things there. If to a slightly less degree, if you go out in Icy Strait and you catch a coho and you can it instead of using tuna fish, you have a much better idea of what that cost. If you go out in the woods here and thin out the pines and you burn them for firewood, which is what we're using for heat right now, you cut every one of those trees down with your own hand, you have a decision, a little moral decision to make every time. So the heating of your house is a moral act. And I just try to, within reason, to where I don't become some eccentric old crank, I try to maximize that kind of stuff.
What's happened is that the town doubles in size, at least in the summer, as this tourist season begins. And so a lot of the people who come in with that are not community-oriented. they're not overwintering types. They're in it because it's a job, or if they're entrepreneurial instead of just employee, they're in it to make money. So we're going through some interesting dynamics here on that. There is a certain individual who is coming into town on a naked entrepreneurial bent. Greg's daughter Kathy cuts hair here, and he came into her salon, and she sort of asked him how things were going. He said, it's going great here. He says, I'm going to make some money here and rip the cream off the top and then go on to the next place. Well, Kathy was born and bred here and is living here and building her own house with her partner. She whipped off the apron or whatever you put on when somebody gets a haircut and, you know, sort of pointed the way to the door. I don't want to cut your hair. That kind of thing is happening. We're seeing a landslide of things developing. That sort of balance that Greg ended with is changing now. It's no longer that balance. There's new dynamics, and so we're trying real hard to, among other things, where the community is debating the idea of incorporation to perhaps give us some tools to work with these new approaches. Where social pressure used to work, it's not working anymore because these people don't live here year-round. And I think that this transition from a solid base, a deriving resource and sustenance from the land and from the sea, is a heck of a different matter than catering to this ongoing set of brightly attired tourists wandering through and fingering the goods. It's right. Different.
Bill was talking before about the dichotomy between tradition and what is, and tourism very often freezes that dichotomy. And you've got to keep this little glitz, because that's the cutesy part that people want to come see. Folks grubbing around getting a living, yeah, that's the part you try to hide behind the facade, because who wants to pay to see that? So it makes the town into something kind of artificial at its heart.
60 years ago, when a white man first came here, they discouraged Native culture. They discouraged Native language. But these things are gradually coming back. I notice that the Natives are becoming more and more aware of themselves and more proud of themselves, you know, because they're trying to bring it back, the culture back. But most of the younger generation doesn't even speak Tlingit. You know, they don't know the Native language, so it's hard. You know, it's like any other community in the U.S., you know, but the people are depending more on the dollar. They can go down to the grocery store and buy a pound of hamburger or whatever with that dollar. And there's quite a bit of welfare around. If they had to live a self-sustaining lifestyle, I'm sure they could, you know, but they won't have that option if this logging keeps going on. And living in a village like this, we all depend on the forest and the water as one. I mean, this is all we have. One depends on the other. The whole community, whether they realize it or not, they depend on the forest and the water.
Featured on this episode of The Spirit of Place are Elaine Thatcher, Wilbur James Jr., Wanda Culp, Frank Wright Jr., Floyd Peterson, Greg Streveler, Bill Brown, Morgan DeBeer, Alvin Josephi, and Jim Makoviak. This 13-part radio series was produced for the Western States Arts Federation in association with KUNM-FM, Albuquerque, by Jack Leffler and Elaine Thatcher. Funding for this series was provided by the Ruth Mott Fund, the New Mexico Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Utney Reader Magazine, offering thought-provoking points of view on culture and society from over 2,000 media sources. Please visit Utney Reader on the World Wide Web at utney.com. That's www.utne.com. This is Jack Leffler inviting you to remain attuned to the spirit of place. Thank you for listening.